It does matter. And if you win for that moment, you're one of the best actors in the world. It's a moment. Hang on to it.
For me, awards or nominations, it's just about being seen and being heard by a group of people who I really respect. But yeah, I mean, I'm excited to be nominated, and I wish there were more women along with me.
Welcome to the Frames Emmy Special. I'm John Horn, coming to you from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC in Los Angeles.
And I'm Lorraine Olley, TV critic for the Los Angeles Times. Harry Brownstein and Jeff Daniels are just two of the Emmy nominees on the show today, but we'll also have the creators of Black-ish and Glow.
We immediately connected to the theatricality of wrestling.
Art imitates life in the best possible ways, you know, and I kind of feel like that is where we get so many of our stories from.
Plus, what goes into making Game of Thrones in Atlanta?
It's all coming up, so stay tuned. Welcome to the Frames Emmy Special. I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame on KPCC in Los Angeles.
And I'm Lorraine Olley, television critic for the Los Angeles Times. So the Emmys are coming up on September 17th, and today we're going to get to know some of the people who've been nominated, and it's a kind of a phenomenal lineup.
The Emmys are such a massive endeavor, and it's only gotten more expansive. I have to say, I think TV has never been better.
Yeah, I mean, the influence of television on culture is probably greater now than it ever has been. I mean, there's just been such an explosion of great programming. And it's that kind of thing of like, it's so much you don't even know what to watch. And the Emmys really kind of distills that for you.
That's a real problem. It's like hard for me to figure out what series I should watch, how to watch enough episodes of the series that I care about. And I would also say that it's a critical time for TV and how it's dealing with the real world.
Definitely. And if you look at the content of some of the shows that are going to be probably reigning supreme at the Emmys this year, you're talking about The Handmaid's Tale, very topical. But now we're going to start with the comedies.
We have the creator of Black-ish. He's Kenya Barris.
Yeah, I think with Black-ish, what he did is he turned that sort of traditional idea of the family network sitcom upside down. It's a black family living in a white suburb, and it's a comedy. It's, you know, raising kids, it's grandparents, but it's also dealing with kind of heavy-duty subjects like race, inequality.
When I spoke with Kenya, I asked him about the premiere episode of Black-ish, where he used a Schoolhouse Rock-style song to teach his family and friends about Juneteenth. That's the holiday that celebrates the end of slavery.
I am a slave, yes, I'm only a slave. They'll place my body in an unmarked grave. In these Confederate days, it's kind of hard to lift every voice singing.
How did the idea for that episode come about? Because it seems incredibly ambitious, but also particularly relevant.
Well, we knew we wanted to do a musical episode. One of our writers, Gail Lerner, had thrown out, we should do Juneteenth. Like, and she literally said it just jokingly. We all laughed and we kind of thought it was interesting. And for me, it sort of became like this is actually a real thing, is that my son, my oldest son, Bo, came in the room and I was watching something on Columbus. And he's like, you know, he's like, oh, you know, he never set foot in America. And he's 8. And I'm like, oh, son, I think you're mistaken. Of course, Columbus set foot in America. He discovered America. He's like, no, he didn't, Dad. So he looks it up and I'm like, what the f***? Dude, like, he never came to America. Like, hold on, why does this dude have a holiday? And Juneteenth, which I had sort of in the same way I looked at Kwanzaa or wherever, I had blown off. And I realized the reason I had been blowing off Juneteenth was because it makes other people uncomfortable. Other people, meaning the mainstream white America, if you talk about slavery, it kind of makes them uncomfortable. And so it's easier for me not to talk about it.
Railroads,
Wall Street,
the White House and University,
UVA,
we built that.
Chapel Hill,
we built that.
Pyramids,
no, sorry, our Hebrew brothers get credit for that.
Something that really kind of should be like a benchmark in our country's history about the day that we quote unquote were supposed to be free. Everyone was supposed to be free. If we celebrate July 4th, 1776, how is that really Independence Day if everyone wasn't really independent? Not to say that we want to get rid of Independence Day, but shouldn't this have some relevance on that level? It struck a chord with me, and I was a huge fan of Hamilton. I remember watching, and I tweeted Lynn. I was just like, it made me want to get up in the middle of Hamilton and go write. It was so good. It was, and I was like, I would love to do something that sort of spoke to a network audience in that same sort of way.
In moments like this with Black-ish, what it's doing is expanding television. You know, and we talk about like diversity on TV. Yeah, sure, there's that. But there's just the idea of the expanded perspective that makes it better. You're starting to see things that just aren't the same things you've seen over and over and over after decades and decades. It's so fresh and it's so new. GLOW is a really good example of evolutions in comedy on TV. I mean, it's such a wacky idea, and you would think, you know, it's going to be really slapstick, but it actually has a depth in it, and it's from the perspective of women, and it really tackles a lot of things that many sitcoms have not in the past, or comedies.
It was created by Carly Mensch and Liz Flahive. They were working on Nurse Jackie with Edie Falco, and they wanted to create a new series that really featured women in a prominent role. And then they saw a documentary about a real TV show from the 1980s about women wrestlers in L.A., and then they found their idea for GLOW.
We have backgrounds as theater people, so I think we immediately connected to the theatricality of wrestling, and especially 80s wrestling, which is this kind of comic book, cartoony style.
How much acting will there be on this show?
As opposed to what?
Hair pulling.
You don't like wrestling?
Well, I don't really know wrestling.
You don't think wrestling is acting?
It's not, is it? It's more like a sport with costumes, or... I'm sorry, are you hiring actors to play wrestlers, or are we the wrestlers?
Yes.
If you kind of look deeper than the pageantry, it's a really interesting space where you can take stereotypes and prejudices and kind of ugly ideas coursing through a culture at any given moment and explore them.
Here she is, stepping into the ring. But here comes Britannica, a genius in and out of the ring. Brains, beauty, brawn, triple threat.
We had never produced a show that involved this much physicality. Like, you know, even if we had worked on a show that involved, like, musical numbers, we probably would have been a little better equipped to figure out exactly what we needed. But it's really exciting to see what it did to the women, frankly.
We thought it would be the part of the show that, like, you know, the first, you know, sprained ankle, everybody would realize kind of how dangerous it was and kind of how vulnerable they were. And all of a sudden it would become the kind of the scary place, where instead it became the kind of supportive, magical place.
They became such a team. It was so nuts. Like, they would stay and watch each other's matches when they weren't even shooting. You know, they would start this crazy thing where they would be in the ring working, and somebody or AD would yell cut, and they would just all start chanting, "Never cut, never cut, always roll, always roll." And we're like, "Oh my god, we've created monsters who will never leave the ring."
This is John Horn, host of The Frame on KPCC, and you're listening to our preview of the Emmy Awards.
And I'm Lorraine Ollie, television critic for the Los Angeles Times. Comedy is also not always funny, and one show that really plays with the genre is Atlanta on FX.
There's some episodes where there is nary a laugh. There's some episodes that are laugh-out-loud funny. There's some that are almost kind of magical realism. I mean, it's a show that you never know what you're going to get one week to the next.
Among Atlanta's many Emmy nominees is Brian Tyree Henry for Outstanding Supporting Actor. He plays Paperboy in the series.
Here's the sweet spot about how Atlanta works for me. The least I know, the better. You know, I'm not going into, like, you know, the project selling dope. I'm not, like, trying to shoot a gun. I'm not trying to, you know, spit bars in a studio or anything like that. I just wanted the essence of who he was to be there.
I think the essence of who Paperboy really is in a particularly intense episode called Woods. And, you know, he's walking into several different situations where there's almost apparitions there, but then it's also very abstract, and he's kind of facing himself in the future, and he hears the voice of his late mother. It's a really, really interesting and intense episode.
Yeah, that episode was inspired by the death of his own mom, who died in a car accident, and it happened suddenly after the first season of Atlanta had wrapped. He talked with us about shooting that episode called Woods.
I truly believe that the luxury of this show is that most of us are empaths, if that makes any sense. Like, we are very much in tune to each other's spirits, and very much we're all constantly listening to each other's hearts all the time. And because everybody was a part of my life when I lost my mother at the end of wrapping the first season. So I think everyone had very, very had their kid gloves on to make sure that I was, you know, okay. But once we started shooting this episode, it just, you know, it was no holds barred. You know, like we had to. I couldn't hold anything back.
Who's that?
What the f***, man?
What the f***?
Being in those woods, you know, in the darkness and running and getting beaten up.
Hey, look, man, I don't want no trouble out of it. I'm just passing through.
You looking for them boys? Them bad boys?
Yeah. Yeah, you seen which way they went?
Yeah, I seen. They went that way. Then they went that way. Then they went there.
Grief feels like you're lost in the woods, and hearing her but not seeing her, and then being attacked by this. It took me some places that I just never really thought I'd experience. But I'm telling you, it was the most cathartic thing that could have ever happened. I mean, I'm definitely not the same person as I was when I started that.
That was Brian Tyree Henry. He plays Alfred, also known as the rapper Paperboy, in the series Atlanta. And another comedy that I think is really interesting that has some Emmy nominations is Barry. It was co-created by and stars Bill Hader. He also directs some episodes. And it's about an emotionally shut down hitman. And he realizes, like, his path to happiness is going to be taking an acting class. And it ends up changing his life.
Being a hitman, you have to live in the shadows. The whole thing is that you're anonymous. And then the acting world is wanting to be in the spotlight and being known, you know? And then what we liked about it was that the stakes of that was life. If he is good at his job at acting, he's risking his life.
People who teach acting are a breed unto themselves. Yeah. And the character that Henry Winkler plays in your series has what we will call some unusual strategies to unlock what he thinks is the essence of a performer's soul, I guess.
It's false, Sally.
I know. I got thrown off right before I was about to go on. I was outside going...
Excuse me. I don't give a shit. Even your excuses are false. You're up there. You're stinking up my stage, babe.
I didn't really go to acting. I went to Second City, LA, where I learned improv. So we went to some great acting classes. And this guy just berated this girl. He got her to an emotional place, and she was a full wreck. But then by the end of it, what we thought was interesting was how appreciative she was to him.
She was grateful for
being
torn apart.
She was so grateful, like, wow, thank you for getting me there and everything. And I just remember thinking, like, I've done a bunch of movies, and yeah, most of them are comedies, but I've never had anybody
try to destroy me.
We should note that Henry Winkler is also nominated for Supporting Actor, and it's his first Emmy nomination, despite being the
never
Fonz.
Never nominated for Happiness?
Can you believe that?
There is no justice that
there
the Fonz
isn't.
Was never nominated. Coming up on the Frame Special, we're going to hear from Nikolai Coster-Waldau from Game of Thrones and Sarah Paulson, who stars in American Horror Story. Welcome back to The Frame's Emmy Special. I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame at KPCC.
And I'm Lorraine Ollie, television critic for The Los Angeles Times.
Earlier in the special, we were talking about changes in the TV business and streaming and how that's reflected in the Emmys. And another area of change and expansion is in limited series or movie.
Right. I mean, it seems that actors who have other projects going on, who have a limited amount of time, can take part in these limited series and really get into a project that doesn't take a huge amount out of their life and their time. And that's unlike a series. I mean, people like Penelope Cruz in The Assassination of Gianni Versace, John Legend as Jesus Christ in Jesus Christ Superstar, or Edie Falco in The Menendez Murders are really good examples of that.
I think actors like good material, and I think good material more than ever now is found in television. FX, for example, they have American Horror Story. It's an anthology series. The other day I talked with Sarah Paulson. She's nominated for lead actress as Allie Mayfair Richards in American Horror Story. And this is the conceit of the series. She is losing her mind over the election of Donald Trump.
So bad, you win.
You, Nate Silver! Oh my God, how can they have been so wrong about this?
I think you're trafficking in the world of extremes when you're dealing with the horror genre. And I think with that comes a certain kind of immediacy and potency of feeling that I think means you don't have to sort of traverse any area to reach something for an audience. It's so extreme, and what you have to do to bring it forward is so large that nobody's going to miss it. You know, you're not dealing in the world of nuance.
How did Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk pitch not just the idea for the season, but what they wanted to achieve?
I think they were just trying to do something which we had never done before, which was put us smack in the middle of where we actually were, you know, and to sort of probably delve a little too close to the bone in an effort to get people to really sit up and think about, you know, there was a lot of things that were happening on our show that were sort of prescient. They sort of happened on our, we were filming it and then 2 weeks later Charlottesville happened. You know, I mean, it was all that stuff with the Proud Boys on our show and this sort of white supremacist storyline that was happening. It was all sort of, we were filming it and then it happened. And it was just, I remember as we were shooting it, there were these moments where I would read it and think, oh, I mean, this is so extreme. I mean, this is not going to happen in our country. I mean, these men sitting around in these, you know, not that we don't live in a world, you know, that gave birth to the KKK, right? So, I mean, it's not that that this kind of thing doesn't happen in America. It certainly does and did, and it continues to be more pervasive than we'd like it to be. But I think when I read it and I thought, how can this be America? This can't be. And I thought it was too extreme. And then, you know, these things were happening all over the country. And I just thought, this is a very, very frightening thing to be spending my time doing.
In a good way. Bad way? I mean, what does that mean?
I like to use my whole self. I'm not interested in sort of putting who I am to the side in order to play something. Mm-hmm. So in order to do that, particularly here, I had to call forward a lot of things I think I spend a lot of time trying to push to the side. And instead, I was sort of having to sit in the middle of all the muck of the things that I contend with as a human being. My own fear, my own ignorance, you know, there's a lot of that kind of stuff that I had to sort of sit in. I couldn't move to the left or the right of it in order to do the job.
Sarah Paulson is nominated for lead actress in a limited series for her work on American Horror Story. And Jeff Daniels appeared in a couple of limited series this year. One of them was The Looming Tower on Hulu and then Godless on Netflix.
I think a lot of people know Jeff Daniels as a movie actor, but he talked with us about why he is doing so much television at this point in his career.
I had a foot in television the whole time. I wasn't doing a series, but I was in there because for all I knew, that's where I was going to be. I never bought that I should be doing movies, never bought that I should be starring in movies, ever. I don't look like George Clooney. This doesn't, and they keep hiring me. So you do Dumb and Dumber just to make sure that they know you can do comedy so that when they get tired of you in the dramas, now you've got a range. Now you got Clint Eastwood going, if you can do 2 days in the Valley, that drama, and you can do Dumb and Dumber, you can do Blood Work. So now you're working for Clint Eastwood.
I want to talk about the Emmys for a second. You have two nominations this year, one for Looming Tower and one for Godless. Do those nominations mean something important to you at this point in your career? You won in 2013 for The Newsroom. What do they mean to you?
You can deny it all you want, but to get nominated is validation. It's just validation that other people in your business, they can see the bag of tricks. They can also see the risk. And I think that's one reason why I might have scored two of them, is that this guy took a risk in Godless and it paid off. Might not have. I might have been the worst thing in it. We swung and missed, but I didn't. It worked. Scott, Frank, and I put our heads together and we guessed that it was this. And here comes an Emmy nomination. Same thing with Looming Tower. It's like validation that whatever your approach is working. And don't change that. Keep taking risks. Keep challenging yourself because people will notice. And the next thing you know, it's a great day on Thursday and you're getting two nominations. It does matter. And if you win, I'm sorry. It's just, for that moment, you're one of the best actors in the world. It's a moment. Hang on to it.
Godless, I think, is a great story about where TV is going. This is a movie that writer-director Scott Frank wrote 14 years ago. Nobody wanted to make it. It's too Western. It's too dark. It's too violent. Everybody passed on it. So he was like sitting on this project, couldn't get it made. He takes it to Netflix. I got this movie. And they're like, how about a 7-hour series? And he's like, sure. And Jeff Daniels plays a very scary character, very different from what he does in The Looming Tower.
Yeah, in The Looming Tower, he does play a very different role. It's as an FBI agent, and it's kind of looking at the true... It's a true story, and it's the infighting between the CIA and the FBI before 9/11 and how that possibly contributed to 9/11 happening. I love that series because the way that they actually deal with the Muslim piece. So often when you see, you know, things on TV about that era or about terrorism, they really don't get the Muslim world right. They really don't get their Muslim characters right. The Looming Tower is a really great example of them doing their due diligence.
Lorraine, I want to ask you this. As a critic, how do you figure out what you're going to watch? Because there are not enough hours in most people's days to get through good TV.
You can't watch everything. There's just no way. But you kind of, you know, keep your ear out for what's coming up. And you know, for instance, Hulu's doing some really interesting stuff. So you pay attention to that. FX is doing interesting stuff. Netflix, you're kind of paying attention to what they're doing. Although with Netflix, it's difficult because of the sheer volume.
Yeah, when I was growing up, it was a lot simpler. There weren't streaming services. There wasn't cable. There wasn't a lot of things, just the TV and rabbit ears. With the Emmys coming up, we started to wonder about how people actually watch television. A lot has been made of cord cutters and mobile devices, but is it still possible to enjoy peak TV the old-fashioned way? Here's the Frame contributor Colin Friesen with a letter from a soldier on the low-tech battlefront.
My dearest wife, I'm emailing you from our two-bedroom rent-controlled Silver Lake home to advise that I now understand your need to take leave whilst I attempt this TV viewing folly. A week with no cable, no streaming, or over-the-top services. I pray God forgive me my hubris. My first goal, of course, was to procure a set still possessing enough clarity and overall worthfulness that it might lend its pixels to my endeavor. Thankfully, a friend had not cleaned his garage in many a fortnight and was able to acquaint me to his Sharp TV combination VCR player, but for the simple promise of never returning said appliance back to his domicile. As expected, a test run in the kitchen showed us naught but snow.
Snow, snow.
It's a slightly different shade of snow.
Snow, snow, there's dark snow. Yeah, well... It's pretty consistent through all the channels.
Was I to spend the next few days in absence of programs like The Bachelorette, The Males Do Affirm, or the new season of Orange Beeth the New Pitch? I am reminded that in the year 2009, the federal government opined and lawed into fashion a decree that there would be no more readily available signals over the air without aid of a box capable of digital transubstantiation.
If your TV isn't hooked up to a cable or satellite receiver, you'll need to get a converter box.
Clearly, a sojourn to the local merchants at the Best of Buys was in order, and I soon found myself in possession of an archaic device known as a VHF-UHF antenna that, even before the remainder of my purchases were attached, filled me with hope.
Bueno, por ejemplo...
My best guess was the picture, only a rough outline of a woman, came from south of the border where the old ways still hold sway. My courage and curiosity piqued, I quickly attached the so-called analog-to-digital converter box and reclined, as is my wont, and hit the button marked power.
George. Well, you got the snowboard, so how about new ski clothes to wear on your winter getaway to Sun Valley, Idaho?
The program was familiar and the picture as sharp as a Quaker scythe. But as I started to navigate the rank of channels, I realized any previous notion of my viewing habits would soon evaporate like the morning dew.
That was Colin Friesen with the first part of his letter from a soldier on the low-tech battlefront. You'll hear more from him later in the show. This is John Horn, host of The Frame on KPCC, and you're listening to our preview of the Emmy Awards.
And I'm Lorraine Ollie, Los Angeles Times television critic. And John, let's move into talking about some dramas that are nominated this year for Emmys.
Yeah, I think this is where there is some really amazing work.
What's really interesting about this collection of shows is that, you know, they're hitting on all these kind of different angles, but a lot of them are getting back to some of the fears that we've had this year in real life. If you're looking at The Handmaid's Tale, they're talking about America post a second civil war, and it's a totalitarian society. Women's reproductive rights are on the line. Not even on the line, they're gone. America has alienated Canada, Mexico. You know, children are being ripped away from their parents. It's just like, oh my God, you dove into our hearts.
No, the amazing thing about The Handmaid's Tale is the first season was tied to Margaret Atwood's book. And a lot of people are like, what are they going to do in the second season? And what they did in the second season is they went back in time. Like, how did we get here? In some ways, it's really terrifying. The series is nominated for 20 Emmys this year, including for Alexis Bledel. She's up for Supporting Actress. And last year, Bledel won for Outstanding Guest Appearance in Handmaid's Tale. And this year, there's a lot more of Emily and Emily in the past, including her previous life as a professor, as a gay woman married to another woman, about being separated from her children, about how Gilead really came to be.
She knows that it's the end when she's sent to the colonies. Everyone who's sent there is going to die, so she's no longer making plans for her life after that point, which, you know, was really something that drove her. She was always looking for an escape through the Underground Railroad of sorts of women who would try to get women out of Gilead. So she doesn't have that fight within her anymore. However, she has a lot of anger, and she's been traumatized multiple times, wounded very deeply. So she's been hardened, and she's become vengeful. And in her mind, she's doling out justice to those who she thinks deserve it.
Her fever's back.
Yeah. She's doing it in two ways, too, which are polar opposite, it seems. You know, she's trying to tend to people to make things right there who are, you know, about to die.
Claire found some more duck eggs, traded them for Tylenol.
Don't waste it. She can't even hold down water.
Because she has this knowledge, you know, to where she thinks she can help them a bit, make them more comfortable, and then at the same time, she's doling out justice on the other end of the spectrum.
What did you do? What did you give me?
You know, she sees a woman that she thinks she can take down, and she's gonna make that right, and she does that.
Every month, you held a woman down while your husband raped her. Some things can't be forgiven.
And even though The Handmaid's Tale last year won, and sometimes that will mean, okay, well, we have to give it to somebody else this year, this season has been even better than the first season, which is so unusual. So I really do think it has quite a good chance of winning the top prize.
Wow.
So last year, Game of Thrones was not in the running just because of production time. But this year, it's got a slew of nominations. It's got 22. So, I mean, in the past, when Game of Thrones was in that category, every other show just had to lay down and go, all right, forget it. We're like done. But this is different. We're in a different time now. And HBO isn't quite, you know, ruling the roost like it used to. Although Game of Thrones, the last season was Game of Thrones. It was phenomenal. But there's also some really, really great programming that it's up against.
No, and I think one of the problems for Game of Thrones is it doesn't feel relevant and of the moment right now, which so many other dramas do. We talked with Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who plays Jaime Lannister on Game of Thrones.
If the North falls, we fall. 3 days. The remaining forces in the Westerlands will take the River Road east, will meet at Lord Howe's town, and march together to Winterfell.
When you start the series, do you know where your character is going and how much of it is guesswork?
I knew the first 3 seasons, and that was really exciting. 3 seasons in, I knew that Jaime would lose his hand and he would finally get to reveal to Brienne Tarth why he was known as the Kingslayer. And I thought that was made it so interesting with the beginning, because it's so dark, you know, having sex with his sister, trying to kill an innocent boy, and he's so arrogant. And there's nothing that you can like about the guy in the beginning, and that was just interesting. But since season three, they have been very quiet about what happens next. So we've known just the scripts, which has, for me, been very difficult.
Because you're curious, right? You need to know, like, what am I doing? Where am I going? Where am I going to end up, right? Exactly. You need to know what your motivations are, right?
Exactly. And I had this discussion with the writers, and they said, you don't need to know. I mean, in real life, you don't know. And I said, but what about you guys? When you write, clearly you know where you're going to end up writing. And they go, well, yeah.
When did you become aware that the show was more than a show, that people were talking about it in a way that they don't typically talk about any kind of entertainment usually?
You know, it happened gradually. I mean, remember the first time it struck me was after season one aired. I was in back in Europe, so and the show aired only on a small subscription channel in Denmark, so it hadn't really caught on. But then we went to Comic-Con in San Diego, and walking into the Hall H, and there were 6,000 people going crazy, it did strike me that maybe it was doing better than I thought. And then, of course, when you start seeing other shows referencing our show.
All right, it's almost game time. Get it? Game of Thrones, game time.
Not watching game. Whoa, they are naked.
What did I tell you?
And it's been in so many, like, pop culture in general. You know, one of the moments that was like a make or break moment for Game of Thrones, I think, was episode 9 of season 1, when the hero of the story, Ned Stark, was killed. I remember reading it, that was shocking, but just the response was so overwhelming. And there were so many people saying, I'm never going to watch this show again. But of course, they did.
Now I want to talk about some of the nominees in the variety categories. Lorraine, it strikes me that most of the nominees in variety talk show get a lot of material from one guy in particular.
Donald Trump may have been problematic for many reasons, but he's been great for late night ratings. In the last year, we've seen ratings for Colbert steadily beat out Jimmy Fallon, which could be attributed to Colbert's embrace of politics.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders insisted the president is not a racist, and she had proof.
I think if, again, the person that a lot of his critics say he is, certainly wouldn't have been in business with him for decades. Certainly you wouldn't have had Bill and Hillary Clinton. They attended his wedding.
Yeah, he can't be a racist. Some of his best friends are people who have black friends.
And Colbert isn't alone. I mean, Seth Meyers on his late night show often skewers the president, especially in his A Closer Look segment.
Rarely in our history have we seen a president so engulfed in scandal. It seems like almost everyone around him is on trial or under investigation, and the president himself is scrambling to avoid an interview with Robert Mueller because he's afraid he might perjure himself. So naturally, he wants us all to focus on something else. His dumbass idea for a space force.
We may even have a space force.
And John Oliver, who famously reminded everyone during the election that Trump's family name was originally Drumpf, hasn't let up on his criticism since he moved into the White House.
We thought we'd update you on the ongoing Trump administration scandals that we've been calling Stupid Watergate. A scandal potentially on the scale of Watergate, but where everyone involved is dumb and terrible and bad at everything. Now, last
and
month,
Samantha Bee has been really an outspoken critic of the president. She's gotten actually in a lot of trouble this year, but in matter of fact, that could like kind of work in her favor because she really, really kind of pushed the envelope on what you can say about the presidency.
She infamously used the C word in talking about Ivanka Trump, but she was still nominated, so clearly she did not turn off too many Emmy voters.
You know, a lot of people were offended and angry that I used an epithet to describe the president's daughter and advisor last week. It is a word I have used on the show many times, hoping to reclaim it. This time, I used it as an insult. I crossed the line, I regret it, and I do apologize for that. The problem is that many women have heard that word at the worst moments of their lives. A lot of them don't want that word reclaimed. They want it gone. And I don't blame them.
People who supported Sam B were pointing to what Trump had said in those leaked tapes earlier and saying, look, you know, comedians are there to push the envelope. People that are running for president and that win that office are not. And so this is really a mixed message here.
And I would say Trevor Noah also seems to have finally gotten out from under the shadow of Jon Stewart. His show is nominated and he too often gets fodder from the president.
Well, this is incredible. Kim Jong-un went up against the world's greatest negotiator, the man who literally hired someone to write the art of the deal and got him to give up something for nothing. It's almost like Kim Jong-un did a Jedi mind trick on Trump. You know, Trump was like, yes, I will stop military exercises and I will also pick you up from the airport. It'll be fun.
Yeah, Trevor Noah is a really good example of just how much late night has expanded and kind of pushed into the political territory. I mean, if you think about it, even 2 years ago, it's a totally different game now. They're saying things that if you imagine Carson or even Letterman would have never done.
Or Jay Leno. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Would never have done this stuff.
Exactly.
There's also one late night host whose show is nominated for the Emmy, but he doesn't get very political, and that is James Corden. What do you think of his show?
It's great.
Okay.
It's great. I have to say, you know, it's great in that he is very escapist. And I think if you try and do a thing like Fallon has done where you're teetering between, well, let me hit on some things that are a little political, but let me try and entertain you. It's not working right now. You've either got to be on one end of the spectrum or the other. I think that's what James Corden is doing, and I think he's doing it well.
One of the best bits he's got going right now, not Carpool Karaoke, but the Crosswalk musical.
The Crosswalk Ensemble isn't so much a theater company as it is a collective of cultural revolutionaries.
So he does this at the intersection of Beverly and Genesee right in front of the CBS studios in Hollywood. They literally stop traffic with this musical. It's choreographed by Chloe Arnold, who is nominated for her work. She's a tap dancer, and she's the only Emmy nominee in the category who didn't get nominated for work on the reality series So You Think You Can Dance.
This is very in line with something I love, which is getting the people, meaning general public, to love dance. And that's what we've been able to do with The Late Late Show with James Corden, because people that aren't going to go, let me go watch my dance show, because they already love dance, are sitting at home thinking they're going to watch, you know, a Late Late Show. And next thing you know, they're watching a full-blown production. And now, the average person that would never have seen musical theater got a taste of it.
Remember, if a car hits you, the show goes on, all right? So you roll and you sing. You roll and you sing.
The songs have been cut down to the exact amount of time that the crosswalk is. So,
which is what? Typically 20?
30 seconds. 30 seconds, maximum 45.
And that means you have time to run out, placing props.
Exactly.
Or furniture. And then.
Yes. And you have to decide, is this a preset?
Right.
Where the music, you know, you set everything, music starts. Or is the music going and everybody's running and props land, have to land on time. So then we do like time trials, basically, where once I've set the dance and it's approved by producers and showrunners, then that's where we decide who, how, and what. And where are these props going to get on in time? And then we time how long it takes them to get off. And then we decide what stays and what goes in order to meet the limits. Because in real life, though there are police there to oversee and to protect it all, it's still very real. We're not closing the street down. This is in real time.
That was great, guys. Yeah. Did you hear those car horns? That's a standing ovation.
This show is incredible because it's truly the example of teamwork makes the dream work.
Right.
Because if one person is off, it throws off the whole puzzle, because this is really a puzzle. And I think one of the hardest things is that once James steps in, you want to laugh at everything. But what makes what we're doing funny is that we take it very seriously. So I always have to tell the dancers, you approach the crosswalk like this is Broadway. Like this is the best thing you've ever done in your life. And that's what makes it so funny, because people that are driving by are like, why is there a full-blown production?
Yeah, there's no winking and nodding.
Yeah.
You're doing it for real.
Yeah. So while we're not laughing, we hope everybody's laughing at home.
Chloe Arnold is a choreographer on The Late Late Show with James Corden. If you're just joining us, I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame on KPCC.
And I'm Lorraine Ollie, television critic for the Los Angeles Times.
Okay, Lorraine, now we're going to move categories a little bit. We'll go from Variety Talk to Variety Sketch.
There's been a lot of changes in the business, and that's changed the Emmys. So one change in the variety category is the separation of talk from sketch, and that happened in 2015.
Yeah, before then, it was shows like SNL competing for the Emmy against late-night talk shows, but with the rise of series like Key and Peele and Inside Amy Schumer, I think the Emmys realized that sketch needed to have its own category.
Right. I think the Emmys really had to respond to that. And it's a good thing they did. I mean, they're very different animals.
One nominee is Portlandia. The show was co-created by and stars Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein. And she also has a nomination for directing. And I recently talked with Carrie Brownstein about why she thinks Portlandia works.
I always wanted to make things that felt more pointed or trenchant and satirical, and Fred, I think, was more interested in things that were absurd, and somewhere in the middle was Portlandia.
I want to ask about the Emmys. You are nominated this year for directing for variety series. I think you're the only woman in the category. You're also the only director who directed him or herself and created the series that you're nominated for.
Yes.
I mean, it's probably gratifying, but is it a little odd that you are in some ways an outlier?
Well, you know, I just don't think progress is inevitable. You know, that's just not how things work. And it is frustrating, of course, to feel like an anomaly or to look at the landscape and know that there are more women who are directing and writing and not seeing them recognized. But, you know, we just implicitly have so many biases, and we have, you know, so that, and we have been, there's so much systemic inequality that just because we have sort of an awareness that it exists doesn't necessarily mean that things will change overnight. We're still dealing with structures of patriarchy and capitalism, and we can't just sort of assume that talking about it is going to bring about change in this way that's sort of linear and accumulative. So yeah, hopefully it will be different next year. But yeah, I mean, I'm excited to be nominated, and I wish there were more women along with me.
That was Carrie Brownstein. Her show Portlandia is nominated, and she has an Emmy nomination for directing in the sketch variety category.
A new entry in the sketch space is Sarah Silverman's Hulu series. It's called I Love You, America, and she created it on the heels of the 2016 presidential election.
In an instant, I basically became a liberal doomsday prepper. I really did. Like, I suddenly needed a vest with, like, 1,000 pockets. And for the first time, I felt an actual kinship to the far-right militia person who, you know, thought Obama would end the world.
Sarah Silverman told us that it was actually Mr. Rogers who was her inspiration for I Love You, America.
The show really came about because of my adoration of him and wanting and feeling like we need a Mr. Rogers for adults. And what are adults but kids plus time? A little more closed, a little more scarred. You know, the things he said, like, everything we are has to do with love or the lack of it. And that's why when you go towards people with love, even people you disagree with, you have a better chance to connect and see yourselves in each other. I'm most certainly changed by this experience. And it sounds so serious. It's extremely silly as well. And, you know, and the challenge of bringing kind of hard comedy into this earnest love fest has been really, for me, exciting, you know, to be just so aggressively dumb and my favorite kind of comedy, just so silly and then also so earnest, you know, it has been really a cool challenge.
That was Sarah Silverman, and comedian W. Kamau Bell is doing his own bid to sort of bring understanding to our fractured country with his show, United Shades of America. It's on CNN, and it won the Emmy for Outstanding Unstructured Reality Program last year. Unstructured Reality Program. Don't know what that means, but it won.
Well, yeah, he's nominated again this year as host, and also the show is nominated. And I think, you know, the show is tapping into something that is really, really important right now. It's looking at how divided we are and kind of trying to get past that and certain, you know, let's go in and actually look at the humanity on the ground instead of reacting to how politicians, how politics has divided us.
When United Shades of America first premiered, this is what W. Kamau Bell said about why he wanted to make it.
I used to watch Bourdain show and I used to watch Dirty Jobs and be like, that's the kind of show I want someday. And that was before I ever had a TV show anywhere.
Well, this is kind of in some ways Dirty Jobs too. I mean, the premise which you lay out in the first episode is it's a show about a black guy who goes places either he shouldn't go or where you don't expect him to go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we start the first episode with you visiting some people in the Klan.
Yeah, is that a dirty job, visiting the Klan?
You tell me, you did it.
I did it, yeah, yeah, yeah. Luckily, they didn't let me help. They didn't want my black hands to touch anything.
What did you find out about yourself and about the country through the making of this show that surprised you?
You know, it's funny. We kept saying that every episode was basically about gentrification. Like, that every episode is about one group's fear of another group pushing them out. And sometimes those fears are legitimate. Like, we did a whole episode in Portland about the South Park. Portland has all this influx of hipsters pushing out the black people of Portland. But the Klan is also afraid of the black people pushing them out of this country. That's not legitimate. But every episode, we were in Barrow, Alaska, which is 60% Native, which sounds good until you realize it was supposed to be 100% Native. And so they're afraid of the people coming in and getting oil jobs or pushing them out and telling them not to pay attention to their culture anymore. So everywhere you go in America, people have concerns that they might lose the things and culture that they've worked hard.
They're afraid.
Fearful concern. I don't think I saw a lot of fear, but I do feel a lot of like people being concerned for the future of this country.
That was W. Kamau Bell. He's the host and creator of United Shades of America on CNN. So, Lorraine, we have now reached the final part of a letter from a soldier on the low-tech battlefront. Here's Frame contributor Colin Friesen, who clearly has seen way too many Ken Burns documentaries, exploring what local channels he can get with his old-fashioned TV set.
The Los Angeles cultural mosaic was on fine display, but if one were to judge this city based primarily on its antennaed TV content, you might assume it populated mostly by Vietnamese speakers in need of legal representation or Asian-sourced dietary supplements. I discovered a preponderance of home shopping options, but also stations seemingly designed to appeal to the older members of our community. Some of which, to my consternation, brought forth programs featuring all manner of currently socially dubious thought.
Is marrying Indian women the accepted thing out there?
Well, yes, ma'am. There isn't enough white women to go around.
Which is not to discount the religious component. The antennaed world showed me a multi-channel battle for the souls of this strange new land. I stumbled upon such a program demonstrating Christ's love that pictured an animated Jesus literally dragging a naked sinner by the ankle and tossing him into a pit of maggots that also, by luck or happenstance, were on fire.
Jesus, Jesus, tú eres el Señor!
I moved on. The channel started to swim before my eyes. While the picture quality was pleasing, there was often a delay of the sound, giving the speakers the dubbed quality normally associated with a spaghetti western. There were many vintage programs, but my thirst for anything reminiscent of peak TV seemed doomed to remain unquenched. And yet I persisted, moving through the channels in the 40s, into the 50s, and then the 60s, where PBS had forged a battlefront. I was losing all hope when the most miraculous thing occurred.
Yes! Which school and what are you studying?
I'm going to UC Riverside and I'll be studying business marketing.
I was back in familiar land with CBS and Let's Make a Deal. Yes, like a greenhorn lost in the woods, I had moved in a full circle. My dear wife, I understand why you had to abandon me during this ill-advised tryst with bygone technology. I am told that a better antenna might improve my viewing prospects, but longing for your company dampens any thought I have of trying again. Return to me, my darling, and I promise a world of overpriced cable television, along with a few supplements that did appear to do wonders for the spasms triggered by the ill humors illustrated in the animated colon. With fondest regards, for you, I remain ever thusly, Colin Friesen.
So, Lorraine, We have finally reached the end of our Emmy special. There are plenty of shows and nominations that we didn't get to. Of those we didn't mention, are there some shout-outs you want to give?
I definitely want to shout out for Insecure for Issa Rae. She's up for lead actress in a comedy, and I really feel like Issa Rae has not gotten the credit she deserves. Insecure is a phenomenal show, and she's great in it. So I'd really like to that to get some love and attention.
And we lost Anthony Bourdain earlier this year. Parts Unknown is nominated for informational series or special. What Anthony Bourdain was trying to do with food was important. He was looking at food as a way to bring this country together and to understand different cultures. And I think his voice is sadly lost, but I think it also reflects on a lot of what's happened in television for the better in this past year.
That's right. I think a lot of what's been going on in television is about bridging that divide. And I think he inspired a lot of people. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in his wake that's kind of influenced by him.
The Frame is produced at KPCC in Los Angeles by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett.
Our engineer is Valentino Rivera, and our intern is Maria Alexa Kavanaugh.
You can get The Frame podcast wherever you find great podcasts, and you can keep up with us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Frame.
And I'm Lorraine Olley, television critic for the Los Angeles Times. You can follow me on Twitter at Lorraine Olley.
And I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame. You can find me at JG Horn. Lorraine, thanks for coming in. Everybody who's listening, happy TV viewing.